This is the Heartland Collegiate Compendium. Principles of Macroeconomics, Econ 10201. Lecture 18, delivered on the 2nd of April of 2009. The title of this lecture is Aggregate Supply, Aggregate Demand, and the Long Run.
Today, Aggregate Supply, Aggregate Demand, and the Long Run. This story begins with the aggregate demand curve and the aggregate supply curve. You will recall that the aggregate curves are mapped out in aggregate output versus aggregate price level space. Now, the aggregate demand curve is downward sloping like its microeconomics, I shouldn't say the word equivalent, but that's about what it is, equivalent, but it does not slope downward for the same reason. In microeconomics, the dominant reason that the demand curve slopes downward is because of the substitution effect. As the price of a good rises, consumers will tend to substitute away from that good because its price relative has risen to other products that can be substituted for it. But in macroeconomics, that cannot be why it happens, because we are talking about all goods, so we can't have the phenomenon of substitution going on. It would have to be another reason, and the reason is rather simple. The aggregate demand curve slopes downward simply because as the aggregate price level rises, if you're holding income constant, which you would be on an aggregate demand, a single aggregate demand curve, consumers would simply have less money to spend on everything. And therefore, if we start with an aggregate price level P1, which would lead to an aggregate output level Q1, if the aggregate price level rises, then consumers have to spread their fixed income across more goods, so the aggregate output level, the aggregate demand level of the economy would go down. So we have the aggregate demand curve sloping downward through what is essentially an income effect. Now the slope, the steepness of that effect is driven by several forces I won't go into here, but I do want you to read about them in the textbook. It explains them quite well. Some of the reasons for the difference, for the elasticity. Suffice it to say, though, that the aggregate demand curves I will draw will be moderately downward sloping, about a 45-degree line. We don't think too much about that slope for the purposes of this course. Now, the aggregate supply curve, just like the microeconomics equivalent of it, slopes upward in output, aggregate output, aggregate price space, but not for the same reason as the microeconomics version does. In microeconomics, the aggregate supply curve slopes upward because as the price of a product rises, firms will move their factors of production towards that product because the opportunity cost of using their factors of production to make alternatives is rising. So they can make more money by simply, they are wasting their time, they're wasting their resources by using them to make other goods when the price of a given good is going up. However, in macroeconomics, the aggregate supply curve does not slope upward for the same reason. This gets a little bit more involved because you have to look at the long run versus the short run. Now, the short run is a Keynesian world. The short run is a Keynesian world. The long run is a classical or neoclassical world. The long run is a classical or neoclassical, and I'll write it neoclassical for here, although the classical economists would have made the same point. The distinction I will make here between these two will, in a sense, evaporate because they are not competing models. They are actually the same model. One is a short-run model. The other talks about the long run. And there is not a Keynesian or a neo-Keynesian worth his or her salt who would argue that the long run is not a neoclassical model. However, in the neo-Keynesian or the Keynesian world, we are talking about the short run, and the aggregate supply curve is highly elastic. It is more elastic the stickier an important factor of production is in its rental rate. As prices, as the aggregate price level rises, that simply says all prices on average are going up. But you can have some prices go up more, or at least more quickly, than other prices. Specifically in the Keynesian world, there are factors of production that do not rise in price as fast as all other prices do. The one that is always brought up is the factor of production called labor. When prices go up, aggregate price level goes up in an economy, wages do not respond immediately, simply because most wages and salaries are paid according to forward contracts. You agree for a period of time to a certain wage, and then later there is a wage review. Also, you have the factor of, with wages, you have the factor of sensitivity to the economic environment. So, for example, if you had an inflation rate that was fairly robust, prices were going up fairly quickly. Now, you might think, well, you cannot get the wages up right away because people have fixed contracts, and there would have to be sort of a lag there before people could say, I want more money in my pay review. But there could be another factor, too. Suppose you had inflationary pressures, but you also had a high unemployment rate. You had essentially something like a stagflation or an inflation and a recession happening at the same time. You, as workers, would be crazy to demand higher wages in a high unemployment environment. If you had a job, you'd be grateful for it. You would not demand higher wages. And even when businesses hired more workers, those workers aren't going to go in there and pound their fists for big, big wages. They're going to be grateful to get a job again. So there could be several reasons why the wage rate would not move up as quickly as the overall inflation rate, as the overall aggregate price level was rising. If that is the case, then that factor of production is not going to have to be paid more. Firms will be able to raise their prices. They will, of course, have to pay higher rental rates to some of their factors of production, but one of their factors of production is stuck. That means that firms have an incentive to produce more in aggregate because they can make more money. One of their factors is stuck in its wage while their prices for what they sell are going up. That is, historically, we see it. You see it. I showed you an article, several graphs in my series, The Economics of Wreckage, where you can see that wage growth lagged overall inflation. You can see it. It's quite clear that this effect is there. The sticky wage effect has been there. Eventually, wages catch up. But even, you see, there's even a kind of a nastiness about that because, okay, price level went up 5% this year. Well, next year, thank God, I finally got my 5% increase. but you stayed there for a year, you lost. And you'll not get that back. You'll never get that back. So even though you will eventually catch up with inflation, along before that, you had to work harder. You had to give up things that you wanted to buy. And so when your wage does finally go up, you've permanently lost ground to inflation. Over the past half century, most decidedly, but I could have done it further back than that, you will look at a graph that I did in my series, and you will see that the real wage, even though nominal wages, in other words, the wages you see, have gone up nicely, very steeply, over the past 50 years, the real wage, the wage adjusting for inflation, has been pretty much flat. Pretty much flat. If you use realistic numbers for inflation, not the government's, but some of the more realistic numbers that are done by private groups, you would find that actually wages have lost ground to inflation over the past 50 years. We are actually not making as much in terms of purchasing power as our grandparents, or well, your grandparents did. That's the reality of it. You done been screwed. Your parents were screwed. In fact, your grandparents were probably screwed too. It looks like, well, geez, we make a whole hell of a lot more than our parents did. But it is not the case that it really, in terms of purchasing power, it's any better. Now, you can argue, well, we have better products now. And the government, in fact, shaves off some of the inflation rate that it reports to you, saying, well, the quality of products is better now. And of course, that's a disingenuous game. That's baloney. The government also shaves a little bit off inflation numbers that it publishes and tells you about by saying, well, when prices go up for one good, people will just substitute away to another good. Now, over a period of time, you think to yourself, well, yeah, you could keep talking about substitution effect, Eventually, we're substituting down to the level of dog food. More importantly, though, the substitution effect, that argument is just completely phony. Because if you substitute away from one product to another product, that just makes the demand for that product go up, so its price goes up. So, no, you can't just say, well, there's a substitution effect, so even if the price rises, we'll cut a little off that based upon the elasticity of the demand for the product, because people will move away from that product. Well, yeah, they'll move away from it maybe if they can, but if they'll move to something else that's higher, and that will cause that price to surge. So the government, let me be diplomatic about this. The government lies to you about this. Well, spank me Jesus, the government lies. Yes, the government lies about this. It has all along, and it does to this day. It keeps finding ways to not report the full force of inflation that is going on in an economy. And it's not one party or another that's done all the time. It's done, some of the most dramatic ones were manipulations, alterations of how CPI is reported were done during the Clinton administration, in fact. But moving back to my story here, the short-run Keynesian aggregate supply curve is shallow in its slope. It's highly elastic because in the short run, if the overall price level increases from P1 with aggregate output level Q1, aggregate supply quantity supplied, Q1, to aggregate price level P2, which would be associated with aggregate output level Q2, there's going to be a considerable increase in the real aggregate output of the economy, simply because firms will be able to deliver more real product to the market because they can charge more for what they are selling. But at least some of their factors of production don't have to be paid more for producing it. And so we have the oddity that mere price level increases in an economy can create a real effect in the short run. It's not, there's nothing really going on except for aggregate price level increasing. It's not some stimulus that is fundamentally causing technological change or anything like that. It's merely the artifice of aggregate price level increasing, but it does create an actual real output level increase. Now, eventually, wages will catch up. And the aggregate supply curve, in the long run, the LRAS, as I write it here, is vertical. Because you can't, in the long run, create a real output effect by merely raising all prices. Wages will catch up. All the factors of production will have to be paid more. And so there would be no reason for manufacturers to produce more. There would be no reason for workers to work harder. They've gotten their wages up to match the inflation rate. So therefore, they don't have to be more productive in the workplace. So the neoclassical, or even the classical world of the long run, would state pretty much the obvious. Sooner or later, you will return to your original aggregate output level, regardless of how you stimulate the aggregate demand, simply because you can't create a real effect by just doubling the money supply. You can't. You just can't. So, in the short run, though, in a framework where we are drawing aggregate demand and aggregate supply, the aggregate demand has a robust downward sloping appearance, and the aggregate supply curve has a shallow look to it. It's highly elastic in the short run. So, what can happen then is Keynesian policy prescriptions can have real teeth. Because if there is some way that you can stimulate the aggregate demand curve, print money and put it into people's pockets, create a stimulus through lower interest rates so consumers go out and buy more stuff, you can get the aggregate demand curve to slide outward from 81 to 82. And you can, as a result of that, actually get the real output level of the economy, the GDP, if you will, to rise. From Q1 to Q2. And the full blunt force of inflation resulting from the overstimulus, from printing too much money, for example, is not there. You get a modest aggregate price level increase simply because the labor is not getting its share. This effect will be stronger the more important labor is in the manufacturing mix, in the technological choice that is being made by the companies. For example, if we had an economy where labor was minimally important and machines and computers were everything, and they could capture their share of any aggregate price level increase very quickly, you would not have a very shallow aggregate supply curve. To the extent that we have labor as an important factor of production in technologies, we will have this shallow aggregate supply curve. Now, I'm throwing a lot of... If you are understanding what I'm saying here, if it's making sense to you, then you should be afraid because you are actually becoming an economist. And so we're halfway through our journey to the dark side, my good Keeblers. if this is actually... you get what I'm doing here. You see, because this aggregate supply curve is shallow because there's an important factor of production that's not rapidly capturing its share of extra money being printed. It's not getting its rental rate going up. So if you've got an economy that is labor intensive, you get much more of a punch than you do in an economy that is becoming less and less so. Well, fortunately, we do need our labor, and especially at lower level jobs anymore. We so far haven't gotten a computer to fully take orders at McDonald's, although it's going to get there someday. But you see, the Keynesians were not stupid. We're increasing the aggregate output level to the purpose of getting to some target. But the target is really not as much GDP as it is unemployment. Because as you increase the aggregate output level, you hopefully decrease the unemployment level. This is especially going to be a useful thing because if labor cannot capture its share of increases in the overall price level, then that means that employers will hire more workers because the prices of the products they're selling are going up, but they don't have to pay workers more, so they can hire more workers. And they can make you who are still employed work harder. You have to because you have to eat. And everything is going up in price. So this effect is strong, especially in a recessionary environment. When there are a lot of people needing jobs and they're not going to demand big wage increases. And a lot of people who have jobs are scared to death that they're going to lose their jobs. They're not going to pound their fists for a big pay raise at their review. So this effect is quite strong in recessionary environments. Unfortunately, once the economy starts to expand and the labor supply gets tight, then wages will start going up very quickly. And you will begin to move towards that longer run situation. Where eventually you would have this aggregate supply curve, AS, which is in the short run here, begin to look more and more like a vertical line, like that. Would look more and more like a vertical line. Long run aggregate supply. So you would see that what would eventually happen is that Q2 would evaporate back down towards Q1, and you would get more and more of the full force of inflation from the overprinting of money occurring as we move towards the long run. Now, the Keynesians would say, well, yes, exactly. Which is why, as soon as the economy begins to breathe, you have to have a Fed that is right on the job, a Federal Reserve, that can start clawing that excess liquidity back out of the market. You have to do it carefully. You can't just instantly drag it out of the economy because interest rates will skyrocket. Because remember, interest rates are the price of money. So if you suddenly drain the liquidity all at once, interest rates pop through the roof, and consumption, investment, and net exports fall through the floor very quickly. So you can actually knock your economy on its ass doing that. You see, you don't want to do that. You can actually create what is essentially like a double dip recession. So you have to have masterful, very well-designed monetary policy and fiscal policy that can know when to start pulling in the money supply and know how to do it carefully so that you keep the momentum forward in the recovery and the expansion. The question is, do we have a Federal Reserve that could do that? The answer to that is we won't have to worry about the answer to that for a while because we have so much slack in the economy right now. The unemployment rate is 8.1%. You know, if I were to say the natural unemployment rate is maybe 4.5%, we're going to be able to a lot of workers will need to be hired before we'll start to see wage pressure. Factory capacity. I might be happy at 80 to 85% factory capacity. Right now, does anyone know where factory capacity, how much of factory capacity is being utilized right now? Well, the 80 to 85% I might be comfortable with. Right now, we are at a record low of 67%. So, in other words, there's going to be a lot of slack in the factories that can be taken up before you start to see price increases on factors of production like physical capital, factory physical capital. So there will be room here for a while as the economy begins to claw itself back from this very bad recession. And it is a bad one. It doesn't look as bad out here as it is in some parts of the country. It's really bad out east and in the west, someplace out west. But we'll have time. But that's the problem, is that you have to say, where does the Federal Reserve begin to claw back these enormous trillions of dollars of overhang in liquidity that have been building, not just from the Obama administration's saving of the banks and the stimulus package and all that. This overhang had been building for years and years during the Bush administration, when the Fed was pouring far too much money into the economy in terms of M2 and M3. So we've got a large amount of money. When do you start to claw that back? And not just when, but in what character? It would be logical to start with M3. That is not part of M2. In other words, get that highly illiquid money, claw it back, get rid of it, pull in M2, and then begin to slowly drain M1 back down. Unfortunately, we're nowhere near where we should be doing M1 now, and M3 we can start to pull back in. Are we doing it? Not yet. But how do you, not just when do you do it, but what are the details of how you pull in the money supply before we start to get real inflationary pressures popping up? They are there already. We see them. They're parked under there, just bubbling. But they're not coming to the surface yet. We know they're there. We know they're there. And we see them sneaking out, especially in sensitive commodities. You see them showing up, like gold. You see the price of gold is just ridiculously high now. You ever hear anyone say, buy gold? Don't do it. You're stupid. It's too late. Whenever normal people hear that there's a great investment, that's when the powerful people have already made their money off it, and now they're going to sell it to the suckers. Okay? No, you can't get ahead of the game. But this was the Keynesian world, and the classical world that followed it. The problem was, politically, it's a lot easier to stimulate than it is to destimulate. It's always easier to say, jobs for everybody, money in everybody's pocket, more unemployment benefits, a higher minimum wage. It is always easier to stimulate. Politically, there's nothing wrong with that. That's the pandering that a politician has to do to get reelected. Now, the Republicans are now the party of no. No, we shouldn't be stimulating. They can conveniently do that because they are in the minority. They can conveniently do that now because they were so excessive and profligate in their ridiculous spending and monetary policy while they were in power, that they can now play the bad guy. But realistically, no politician is going to get very far in office by constantly saying no to a great stimulus package. No, we're not going to give more student loans out. No, we're not going to increase the Pell Grants. We're going to cut them. No, we're not going to have more unemployment benefits. No, we are not going to do this, that, and the other thing to make the economy stronger. That's a prescription for getting kicked out of office eventually. Eventually getting kicked out of office. Because even though people can sometimes say, yeah, I understand your point, it's still going to be more popular to take the tax cuts and all those kinds of things. Those are one of the worst things that can happen, too, especially long-term tax cuts. You see, one of the worst parts of the last stimulus, well, the worst part of the last stimulus was that we stimulated the economy when we didn't have a recession in 2001. The second worst part of it was that the tax cuts, which were crucial to it, were done for 10 years. 10-year tax cuts for a recession that didn't even happen. You see, there's when you have that, you're doing long-run policy to deal with a short-run problem, and there wasn't even a really short-run problem at that point. So that's a real danger, is doing things that last too long. And then, and also the other thing is, it's a lot easier to give a benefit than it is to take that benefit away. So the real trick, politically, is being able to get rid of this excess liquidity and let the aggregate demand curve stay out here because of natural economic recovery and expansion instead of trying to sustain it out here through more and more money. Because what will happen is this. Over a long period of time, there is always a short-run aggregate supply curve. There's always going to be one. But the character of that short-run aggregate supply curve can change. You see, it's sort of like this. If I punch money into the economy just every once in a while, just when it's needed, the markets will react to that extra money with real output increases, as long as you pull that money back out before inflation gets too bad. But after a while, if you just keep doing that and doing that, the short-run aggregate supply curve begins to lose its elasticity. It loses, for lack of a better term, it loses its gullibility. Workers no longer wait for inflation. They expect inflation. Banks no longer wait for inflation to put a premium into their interest rates. They expect the inflation. Manufacturers no longer wait for inflation to raise their prices. They expect the inflation, and they put it in there before the inflation even happens. So what can happen is that over a period of time, if I were to write this short-run aggregate supply curve, this very shallow one, as the first time that the government would push money into an economy. If the government just keeps doing round after round of pouring money in, the short-run aggregate supply curve is going to become less and less elastic. It's going to look more and more like a long-run aggregate supply curve because that factor price that was not responding, which caused the aggregate supply curve to be so elastic, starts responding in front of the printing of the money. So notice what will happen. With each round of economic stimulus of the aggregate demand curve, 81 to 82, notice how you get less and less of a real output level effect, and more of just a pure inflation effect. With each additional round, as the short-run aggregate supply curves become less and less elastic, and they're becoming less and less elastic, again, because the sticky factor of production, the factor of production that had the sticky wage, the sticky rental rate, labor, starts becoming unstuck faster and faster. You would see that in unions becoming more muscular, getting in front, stop rolling over for management. In your lifetimes, unions have been very weak. You don't remember the time when unions would knock heads. They would just strike right away. The political environment changed radically. But that wasn't when Reagan fired all of the PATCO workers because they struck for a higher wage. That was a backbreaker. But in terms of economic policy, it's not the first time we've seen an act of government to break the back of responsiveness of a factor price. The Labor Management Relations Act of 47 was another gambit to do the same thing. And you look at it in the time that it happens. Ronald Reagan said, well, we have to have our air traffic controllers. It's a national matter. So I'm going to have to fire all these people because it's too important to have our traffic controllers on the job, air traffic controllers on the job. Oh, horse shit. It was purely a matter, from a long-term economic perspective, of breaking the back of that steepening short-run aggregate supply curve. Now, the people of the time wouldn't have seen it that way. We have to sit back in historical perspective and understand what was really the point. It had nothing to do with national safety and all that. It was purely a matter that the excesses of the 60s and 70s in terms of monetary policy had gotten so severe that the short-run aggregate supply curve was parked quite steep. At least for parts of the economy, wages were responding before there was even an aggregate money supply increase. By the time Reagan broke the back of PATCO, the Fed was in contractionary monetary policy. It wasn't doing it anymore. It wasn't overprinting money. But the aggregate supply curve, short-run aggregate supply curve, wasn't going to go for that. No, we're not going to have sticky wages anymore. We're going to get in front of inflation. And even though there wasn't going to be much more inflation. So the act that was a political act of firing all of the PATCO workers, that was a union for the air traffic controllers, it was purely part of a larger economic scheme of getting the elasticity back to where it would normally be in a Keynesian short-run framework. So ultimately, political acts have to be part of the overall method by which an economy that has gotten into this bad situation with a steep short-run aggregate supply curve returns it to a shallower short-run aggregate supply curve. Now, the last part of this story, and then once I've given you this, I will take you back to an earlier discussion having to do with the equation of exchange. And if you have not seen my Google video on the equation of exchange, the link to it is on the hcc-prof.com website. Watch it. It makes it living and very quite strange, I guess, but you will see this again in that how I close this lecture. You'll see it again in a rather vivid framework. But I have a mystery that I've never really answered for myself about what I'm going to tell you here. There was an economist in the 50s. His name was Phillips. I believe it was A.J. Phillips. Now, an economist most economists aren't out there being very public people. Now, there are a few of us who try to get ourselves prominent and known. Certainly, Paul Krugman was very successful. He got a Nobel Prize for it. Brad DeLong, an economist at a university in California, he's pretty well known. And I'm known out there, and we stick our heads up above the sand and talk to the public, especially Krugman does. I do. We are the kind of economists who make our lives more or less popularizing economics in one way or another. Most economists don't live their lives like that. Most economists kind of stay in academia, very quiet, doing their research papers, publishing or publish or perish. You have to get a certain number of papers published your first couple of years you're hired, or you get kicked out. If you do good papers, then they'll give you a contract so that you've got a job for life. That's called tenure. So there's this big drive among academic economists to publish, to collect data, or to write theoretical models and get that tenure that every economist or every professor seems to want. And I would reject, I've rejected the concept of tenure, because what it usually does is make for someone, after you get tenure, you can just rot and you don't have to be a good teacher. But whatever. But most economists make their lives publishing papers. Some do theoretical work, which is quite important, but you look at it, you say, ha. Some of the papers that, most of the papers that are produced these days, you just, what the hell? I'm okay with it, but I mean, for a normal person to read this stuff, what the hell does this have to do with anything? I don't even understand what you're doing here. But then there are the economists who take that theoretical work and they do empirical work, in other words, collect data. Now, a lot of that is badly done, and as it is in all fields, you hear about, well, they have found that. Well, that's usually because they've had some desperate guy or group that needed a paper published, collect data, and do very bad statistics. Statistics should not ever be done by people who do not have probability theory background, but it's done all the time. And here we are going to talk about an example of what was an interesting result of a data collection study in economics in the 50s. And my problem here is I do not know the extent to which the economist who did this, Phillips, was fully conscious of the fact that he was simply confirming a short-run Keynesian model. Look, here's what he did. He just essentially, he said, I'm going to collect data. My observation variable, my input variable, my independent variable will be the unemployment rate. And I'll look at the unemployment rate in a country at a given time, and I will look at that country's inflation rate, its wage inflation rate, and I will write that as pi on the vertical axis. So I will be able to find a coordinate pair, unemployment, comma, inflation rate for a country like the United Kingdom for at a given time. And I will collect, I found this one unemployment rate, and I'm just making up some numbers here. It was 12.3%. The unemployment rate was, let's say, 2.3% when the inflation rate was 18%. And I'm just making up numbers here. Collect another data point from another country or from another time. And you get I found that over here when the inflation rate was 1.6%, the unemployment rate was 14%. It's really just collecting XY coordinate pairs. Look at a country at a given point in time, look at what was its unemployment rate, what was its inflation rate, and just plot those. Now, ideally, in the mystical, magical way of thinking about how science proceeds in empirical work, what we are trying to do is find an underlying principle of the universe, we're trying to find an underlying function, a process, an equation that governs the relationship between two or more variables. And when we collect data, We're not going to see perfect curves like you do in math. We're not going to see those because data is always going to have noise in it, errors, measurement errors, just other small minor factors pushing the data points around. So what we will see in practice, if we are lucky and we have a good theoretical idea, we will see a scatter plot. But if we are lucky, that scatter plot will have a hint or a very strong hint of a shape. So what we are seeing is nature whispering to us, there is really a true, pure process here. But the wind, the noise, will make it a little bit hazy what it really, really looks like. And our job in statistics, but we have to have good, strong probability theory background or we can be misled very easily. But in statistics, what we're trying to do is see what the whisper is. See what is underneath there. See what that truth the universe is trying to tell us is. And that's what all data collection should be about. And certainly, A.J. Phillips found an amazing thing. The data was very tight for. I mean, a lot of times you'll collect data and it'll just be all over the world. Well, what the hell? There's nothing obvious. This was obvious. There was a downward sloping curve, evident, quite evident in the data. There was clearly a negative inverse relationship between unemployment and wage inflation. There was no question about it. This came to be known as the Phillips curve. The Phillips curve. And it was striking. It was there. It was quite clear. Yeah, there's no question. This is not data all over the map. This data is clustering around a very distinct curve that is downward sloping. In other words, it is pretty obvious that higher unemployment rates are associated with lower inflation, and lower unemployment rates in our sample are associated with higher inflation. And we can even estimate the exact look of the equation that relates unemployment to inflation. So that we can go from a data collection exercise to what appears to be a policy template. We can actually, if we know the shape, exactly how this equation works, we could select an unemployment rate that we wanted and then just put the inflation rate at the right level to get that unemployment rate. That's what the Phillips curve was telling policymakers. You can choose an unemployment rate by creating a specific inflation rate. The Phillips curve was like, I might be going too far, but perhaps not. The Phillips curve was like a holy grail. Because we had wanted, in the Keynesian era, we wanted a way by which we could make the unemployment rate what we desired. We had a target, a natural unemployment rate that we obviously wanted to achieve as a matter of public policy in the Keynesian era. Now we know by the Phillips curve how to get there. Pretty much exactly. We just create the inflation rate that will be associated with that unemployment rate. Well, the Phillips curve was definitely quite popular in its time. Right away, the policymakers saw, yes. If unemployment rate is at 5% and we want to get it down to 4%, we just raise the inflation rate from such and such to such and such, and we'll get our unemployment rate down to where it belongs, where we target it, to the natural rate. So, there you are, the solution to all the problems of the universe. The solution to all the problems of the universe. But unfortunately, if you think back, and this is where what I was talking about, I'm not really sure whether Phillips really understood that, first of all, when you collect data, unless you do some pretty fancy stuff, you are always collecting short run. You are looking at a short run phenomenon. Collecting data is like taking a snapshot. That's going to be a short run. Long run, if you're looking for long run relationships, that's another matter. And you have to collect your data differently, more thoroughly, longitudinally, whatever. But this was a snapshot. So what happened was, okay, we have an unemployment rate that is actual. And I'll write that as, let's say, U actual, U sub A. Which is associated with an inflation rate, a wage inflation rate, pi a. Now let's say that unemployment rate is higher than we really want it to be. Well, now we have, by the Phillips curve, essentially an equation. We could raise the inflation rate. Let's say that the unemployment rate that we want is UT, the target. We could raise the inflation rate from pi A to pi T, and I'll write that as pi T1, pi T sub 1. And we get, we got it. No doubt about it. No doubt about it. But remember what's happening in the Keynesian aggregate supply, aggregate demand framework. What we just did was to print money . And by printing money, we stimulated the aggregate demand curve, which pushed prices up a little bit. That would be pi A to pi T1. And we increased aggregate output from Q1 to Q2, which is the same as saying that we drove unemployment down from U sub A to U sub T. We increase aggregate output that lowers unemployment. There's no question. Phillips found what essentially the Keynesian model would say. Yeah. Validated. The model, the theory, actually is supported by the data. And now we have an actual empirical equation, perhaps, so that we can put this into policy practice. To the extent that we can control exactly where we hit what inflation rate we want to hit. So we're all good. Well, this might have been the world of the early 60s, when Kennedy administration did tax cuts, that even some of his own advisors said, this is not a good idea. But we printed money, and a little bit of inflation came along, and we certainly got the economy boosted some. Coming out of the recession, there was somewhat of a recessionary environment when Kennedy came into office. Eisenhower advised against too much stimulus because it was in some way similar to this 2001 economic environment. There was more of an economic pause. It was a little bit of a downturn, but it was not severe. And Eisenhower had resisted any kind of stimulus. The Republicans in Congress were just screaming, tax cuts, tax cuts. And in Eisenhower's last speech before Congress, wonderful speech, the one in which he warned about the military-industrial complex. He actually took on his own Republicans, and they sort of like this giant general, and just sort of kicking the little dogs aside in his speech. They called for tax cuts, and they can go just kiss my ass. He didn't do it like that, but you could tell he was just a giant of a man. Great Republican, great president. And he essentially said, I'm not going to listen to you screaming for tax cuts and this and that for pro-business and all that. I don't want to hear it. You know, this isn't a bad recession. Well, of course, Kennedy came into office, and he was more of a populist, very modern man, and more with it. So much in this era, and I don't necessarily support Barack Obama, but it's just like seeing the Kennedy administration all over again, that hipness, that with-itness, more connected. And Kennedy said, yeah, we got a problem here. Let's cut some taxes and let's get this economy going again. We can. Yes, we can. In his, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. And all that kind of stuff, you know, getting people all hyped up. Oh, yeah, we're in a new era. He even wants us to go to the moon. Something rather odd happened. The long run came in. And as you know, in the long run, eventually wages will catch up. Wages will catch up, and the aggregate supply curve will snap, will eventually get up to vertical, which means that Q2 will eventually come back down to Q1, which means that the unemployment rate will go from the target back up to where it was originally. What that would mean in terms of the Phillips curve is that essentially the inflation rate is going to eventually creep upward. Back to where it was, the unemployment rate will creep back upward to where it was, and the full effect of the aggregate price level increase will show up. Well, that's kind of strange. Oh, well, apparently there's not one Phillips curve. I'll write that as PC1. Apparently, we're on a new Phillips curve, PC2. Well, that's kind of odd. Okay, fine. Fine. We'll do it again. We've got an aggregate supply curve. We'll print money. And by this time, we had Johnson in office. Social programs and a nice blossoming war in Southeast Asia. Essentially a guns and butter. You talk about stimulus. You're handing out money and welfare and social programs, and you're having a damn fine war. And you have a cause. Oh, back then it was the threat of communism, the domino effect. If we let communists take over in Vietnam, then they'll be in Laos, they'll be in Cambodia, and before you know it, they'll be on Main Street in the United States, those damned communists will. And now, of course, we hear, well, if we don't stop terrorism over in Iraq, it'll be in our country again. Well, how did it get here the first time? Well, they knocked down buildings. Well, yeah, because you fat asses were asleep at the wheel, weren't you, assholes? Look, notice what I drew there. Do you see the aggregate supply curve? Not quite as elastic as it was last time. Wage markets were, oh, wait, whoa. You printed money last time. We'll still buy it. Okay, we'll increase output. Notice how the inflation effect is a little stronger. So what's going on now, and I should draw this, the Phillips curve is getting steeper. So that in order to get the unemployment rate down to where we want, to the target this time, we have to create more inflation. But of course, sooner or later, sooner or later, we are going to discover that the long-run aggregate supply curve will kick in. And the aggregate, the Phillips curve this time will be even worse, because as it tracks outward to get back to the original unemployment rate, we'll get a stronger hit of inflation and it will come a little faster. And so the 60s and the 70s proceeded. We got into a death spiral through the Kennedy, the Johnson, the Nixon, and the Ford administrations. It was like chasing something that was running ahead of us faster and faster, because the short-run aggregate supply curves were getting steeper and steeper, so you had to print more and more money to get any kind of an effect at all. By the end of the 1970s, we were creating just pure inflation. Every time we poured money in, all that happened was just boom, it went into inflation. And even though the Fed was printing money like there was no tomorrow, trying to keep interest rates down, interest rates were through the roof because the expectation of inflation was being embedded in them perfectly. Purely. Before the Fed could even print a dollar, the markets knew that dollar was out there, or was ready for that dollar, and ready for the dollar after that one. By the end of the 1970s, we had terribly high interest rates. We could not even get back to this unemployment target here, because the steepness of the Phillips curve was just like this. You couldn't get back to the target unemployment rate. The short-run aggregate supply curve was virtually a long-run aggregate supply curve. As soon as you tried to stimulate aggregate demand by printing money or doing another social program or doing anything else, well, you would just get inflation. You wouldn't get any effect on the real output level of the economy. Worse yet, though, because interest rates are based upon a combination of the real interest rate and an expected inflation premium, even though the Fed was trying to keep the real interest rate way down there because of oversupply of money, the expected inflation premium was getting bigger and bigger, so interest rates in the economy were going through the roof. And when interest rates go up, consumption goes down, private investment goes down, net exports go down, and so, lo and behold, you have the GDP languishing. We were flopping around with a miserable growth rate of GDP, and inflation was raging. More importantly, though, the part that you don't hear about, expected inflation was raging. So you had what we called at the time stagflation, a stagnated economy and inflation at the same time. We couldn't get unemployment down by printing more money. All that happened with that is we got more expectation of inflation, and that pushed the pushed the interest rates up. And so we came to 1979, near the end of the Carter administration. Now, President Jimmy Carter had followed the same policies as presidents before him had, trying to tell people, we've got to fight this inflation. This is a moral battle. Gerald Ford, it's whip inflation now. We can just say no to inflation. That's all we have to do is say no to inflation. That's like saying no to bleeding out of a shotgun wound. And then, of course, Jimmy Carter, he tried to do it even more as something that was moral. He called it the moral equivalent of war. Meow. He'd get up there, the poor son of a bitch, trying to get everyone to live leaner. He'd get up there in the winter for his chats wearing these giant sweaters. You know, I was wondering if the man is shivering, sitting in front of a miserable fire there in the White House and talking to people. And as if, you know, if we just be more modest, if we stop being greedy, if we stop asking for higher wages, if we stop raising our prices, we'll win this war. It's a moral war. Oh, horseshit, it's not a moral war. It was a technical war. And it had been building for a long, long time before him. Jimmy Carter was not a stupid man. He was an engineer. He was trained as an engineer. He knew math. He knew equations. He knew physical processes. He knew what was really going to have to be done. He was going to have to get rid of the Federal Reserve people who were all these little helper elves who always were just printing money, print, 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 print. And you would look in the Fed and you would sort of like, hi-ho, hi-ho, it's more money to go. He put in there Darth Vader. Paul Volcker. Volcker just went through the Fed. You have failed me for the last time. And all those little elves were dying on the floor. And he put into effect monetary policy that literally just dropped the money supply. Now, remember what I said earlier? You don't want to do that. Because that'll send the economy into a death spiral. Because when you contract the money supply, that drives up real interest rates, which are driven by supply and demand conditions for money in credit markets. So he cracked down the money supply, just clawed the liquidity out like this, like a giant Hoover vacuum cleaner. And of course, that drove the real interest rate through the roof. The expected inflation premium wasn't going anywhere. Everyone, yeah, we've heard this one before. Sure. Yeah, next year I won't ask for any wage increase. As a matter of fact, I'll ask for a cut in my wages next year. Yeah, right. Banks, oh, I hear the inflation's out of the economy, so I'll drop my interest rates on loans back down. You know, sure. No one bought it. The expected inflation, that inelasticity was there, and it was embedded. It had been building for two decades, almost. It wasn't just going to go away overnight. So you had interest rates that were sky high now. The real interest rate was going through the roof. The expected inflation premium embedding in interest rates was already up there in the stratosphere. Oh, the interest rates, I mean mortgages, a fixed rate mortgage on a home, 25%. I mean, it was just like everyone wanted blood. Of course, that it was all Carter's fault. Well, we're going to get rid of that peanut farmer from Georgia, and we'll get a real president. So who do they elect? A guy who was an actor from California, whose most famous roles were in B-movie westerns and Chesterfield cigarette commercials, who promised the moon. Well, you know, when I was growing up, we didn't do things like this. We elected idiots like me who are in pre-Alzheimer's. Whatever. The Fed held its own. And slowly, slowly, the expected inflation premium began to yield. Because we were in a recession, you lose your job, you lose your motivation to ask for a higher wage. Now, don't you, Sparky? You're a manufacturer. And no one's buying your product, you lose your incentive to jack up your prices just because you think inflation's going to get worse. Sooner or later, the markets finally said, okay, uncle. And of course, Volcker said, not uncle, daddy. But by about 82, we began to see that Volcker's Fed saw that the inflation expectations were finally beginning to go. And he could then loosen up on the money supply and let it come back into a pattern that was matching the growth rate of the economy. As the economy was recovering, you began to see monetary policy resync. And so that the growth rate of the money supply was again more or less matching the real growth rate of the economy. And that is one of the best environments in the world for good economic growth. We didn't have spectacular economic growth during the Reagan years, but we had good, solid growth. We had a few ups and downs, and the Fed, after Volcker, Greenspan came in, and he did a few mistakes, but then he got really good, just technically good like Volcker. Later, he would become awful. In the Clinton years, he became a bitter, vindictive liar. And that's what it was. He did not like the growth that he saw in the Clinton era. and he tried to destroy the growth, but it didn't work. He finally was able to, when the next president came in, he was able to do some things that were very inappropriate for a Federal Reserve chairman to do, like support tax cuts when there was no recession. But that was so that he could, again, have the Fed doing open market operations, which it couldn't do by the end of the Clinton administration, because open market operations require government securities, debt securities. They were running federal budget surpluses, so there were no debt securities, so the Federal Reserve could not execute open market operations efficiently. So in order to get the Fed back into business, he had to support the tax cuts that caused us to start spiraling into very serious budget deficits again. But that's a longer story. Where we are now, we are actually still in a very flat aggregate supply curve. How long are we going to stay there? 2 more years. And then that aggregate supply curve is going to begin to start steepening. And so as the Fed pours money in, if it does, it's going to get more and more inflation. Already there is a hidden long-run aggregate supply curve that is waiting for us out there. It'll hit. We've got way too much liquidity out there for it not to hit. But that's for another day. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.